Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Captain America.
Mr. Lang.
Jeez. Look, I want to say, I know you know a lot of super people, so thanks for thanking of me.
Oh, Paul Rudd, you make everything better. Rudd there as new recruit Scott Ant-Man Lang in that scene from 2016 box office champ Captain America Civil War.
We've got our own new recruit for this year's Top 10 of 2016 Roundtable. Genevieve Kosky joins us, along with her colleague from the Next Picture Show podcast, Scott Tobias, as we bring you part one of our countdown of the best films of this outstanding movie year.
Genevieve, not quite as in awe of us, Josh, as Ant-Man is of Captain America.
Try doing that thing where you pull the helicopter out of the sky. That'll impress her.
Done and done. It's all ahead on Film Spotting.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Josh, we are not alone for Christmas for our 2016 end-of-the-year roundtable. We're going to look at the top 10 films of 2016. This is part one. We have a few guests with us. Could this be true? The ninth year in a row on Film Spotting from the Next Picture Show and a host of other outlets, the great Scott Tobias.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome, Scott. That goes well before my time. So.
Yeah, that's true. It's,
yeah, before my first child was even born.
It was such a different time.
Yeah, seriously.
And in for Michael Phillips. Also from the Next Picture Show, Genevieve Kosky. Genevieve, thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Some big shoes to fill.
Big shoes, but really, it was time.
No, because he actually just left them here under the desk. I was wondering what they were, and now I understand.
You know what? It was just one too many email coming from Michael telling me how bad Raiders of the Lost Ark is. I finally just couldn't take it.
You had to boot him off.
I couldn't take it. And the funny part about that joke is 2 weeks ago, he really did email me with yet another jab at Raiders of the Lost Ark. So all the people out there who might be sad that Michael's not here for this show, also would have been his ninth year in a row, I throw that out there so you can feel less bad. You don't want to hear his nonsense if he can't even appreciate Raiders of the Lost Ark. So speaking of big budget spectacles and movies that perform well at the box office, that's actually how we're going to get started here. Before we get to our top 10 picks, we reference Captain America Civil War at the top of the show. It was number two at the domestic box office behind Pixar's Finding Dory. Civil War also had a 90% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, a 75 from critics on Metacritic. I think we both really like this movie. Josh, didn't you have it in your top five of the year so far in July or close?
It was, yeah, it was just outside of the top five. Currently, it's at number 18 on the year for me.
There
so
you go.
Felt quite a bit, but I did enjoy it.
Every slot in the box office top 10 is a superhero movie, an animated movie, a sequel, a prequel, or all of the above, but lots of those movies were pretty good. So before we dive into the more obscure end of the 2016 movie pool, I want to throw out to the group, what do you make of the movies that most people spent money on this year? And Josh, you can list a few more of them.
Yeah, this is the domestic box office top 10, and we've got some Rotten Tomatoes ratings for you as well for each one. Finding Dory, as you mentioned, 94% fresh. Captain America at number two with 90%. And then number three is a surprise to me, one I missed, The Secret Life of Pets, 74% fresh rating. The Jungle Book came in at four, 94%. Deadpool, number five, 84% fresh. Zootopia was a 98% percent fresh rating. And then things start to take a turn here, in my opinion. Number 7 was Batman v Superman. Ooh, and they took a turn on Rotten Tomatoes, 27% fresh rating there. Followed by Suicide Squad at number 8 with a 26% fresh rating. Doctor Strange is number 9, 90% fresh. Number 10, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. That is 75% fresh. It's probably worth noting likely that Moana and probably Rogue One as well are going to make it into the top 10 by the time the year comes to an end.
Yes. So, Scott, Genevieve, general thoughts on those films? Did any stand out to you as particularly strong or particularly awful?
Not well. I mean, Suicide Squad stands out for me as particularly awful, and I will feel much better about this list once Moana joins it.
Hopefully, replacing The Secret Life of Pets, which
that's all the way up to 3, though.
I know. I can't believe that. I can't believe the Rotten Tomatoes rating on that either. Yeah, I did not care for that one.
You didn't see the Angry Birds movie like I did. Again, I have small children, but I will say that it kind of fills me with a little bit of despair, this list, because there were a lot of pieces that came out over the summer that were sort of, this is the end of cinema, this is just the worst year ever, and those pieces I tended to mock at the time, but I think really they were really just about the studio system and lamenting the studio system. And I think when you look at a list like this, even though maybe even half of them or more are pretty good movies, I think these are trends that are lamentable. I think we're looking at studios that have forgotten how to make smaller, more complex films and more distinctive films. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty depressing list. I don't like really this diet of sequels and superhero movies and big time animated films, even though occasionally you get a Moana or something like that. Zootopia I thought was really disappointing, but I guess I'm the 2% of Rotten Tomatoes people who would think that. But what do you think?
Well, I think that's a little more defeatist an attitude than I would take. These aren't the only movies that are being made. They're just the movies people are going to see.
Sure.
And they're the movies that are making the most money, presumably because it costs a lot to go to movies now, especially if you are taking a family with you and people want somewhat known quantities if they're going to be going to the theater for that. And everything on that list is a known quantity. So I think that's what I'm reading into it, less than a lack of imagination on the studios, which is also a factor. Mm-hmm. But I think the bigger factor is maybe just more and more movie viewers wanting to see what they know already on screen. Although there are some, it is interesting to me how much variation there is in the superhero movie field in that list, from Deadpool, which I think was really one of the best of the year, to your Batman v Superman and Suicide Squads. But the superhero movie genre has gotten so big that it now encompasses a lot of variation of quality in its own, which is kind of interesting.
I think the dispiriting element of this list, I mean, anytime you look at a top 10 list that's box office and then critics, there's going to be disparity, right? Mm-hmm. And in general, I'm not too dismayed by what I see here, especially at the top. There are some I enjoyed quite a bit. Captain America, as we mentioned, one of them. But when you see something like number 7 and 8, which are Batman v Superman and Suicide Squad, which are abysmal films. Mm-hmm. And that's not just me talking. You see those fresh ratings, or they should be rotten, I guess, 27% fresh and Suicide Squad 26% fresh. That is a chasm between what is actually making money and means will be made again, and what critics or even just, reviewers or other people who follow movies closely are thinking are terrible films. And so that's where you can project forward. We're going to get more of these terrible films when they make it into this sort of list. But you see something like The Jungle Book, which I think did some interesting new things, Zootopia as well, even Doctor Strange, tweaked the Marvel formula a little bit. That is encouraging, but I just don't want to see more of these Batman v Superman films getting made. It's going to happen now when they make this much money.
The only thing that consoles me is just because they spent money on it, and yes, you're right, they spent money on it, which means the film's made money, so we may get more, but just because people went to it at least once doesn't mean they enjoyed it. And I think in some of these cases, especially with those two films you mentioned, I get the sense that most audiences were not enamored with those films. But speaking of the disparity between critics and audiences, spoiler alert, I think only one of those 10 movies is going to come up over the course of our two-part top 10 films of the year shows. We have a host of special guest and listener voicemails we're going to get to. Let's get the countdown started with a voicemail from a director who has also been a regular part of these year-end roundtables. And his next release, I'm going to predict, has an outside chance of cracking the 2017 box office top 10.
Hello, Adam and Josh. It's Ryan Johnson calling in with my number one film of 2016. So this ended up being a really fantastic year for movies. There were so many good movies that I loved. Moonlight, Manchester by the Sea, Silence was fantastic, Arrival, just so many great films. I'm going to pick as my favorite, though, one that kind of went under the radar. It was called Christine. It was directed by Antonio Campos and written by Craig Shulowich. I probably pronounced that wrong. I apologize. And it stars Rebecca Hall, who gives, no joke, like one of the most stunning performances I've seen in a long, long time. This performance just laid me flat. It's called Christine. I don't want to say too much about it if anyone hasn't seen it, but please seek it out. It is really an incredible film. Thanks so much, guys. Good riddance to 2016. Bring on 2017, and I hope you guys are well. I'll talk to you soon.
Christine, one of my most anticipated movies of the fall and of the year, and I did finally catch up with it, but I know, Scott, you have seen it as well. Your thoughts on Ryan's pick?
I liked it quite a bit. I mean, it didn't make my list, but Rebecca Hall certainly would. I mean, she and Isabelle Huppert and Elle, those are probably my two favorite performances of the year, period. So he's dead on about that. And there was a documentary made also about Christine mm-hmm. Chubbuck called Kate Plays Christine, and those two takes on her could not be more different, and I think it's fascinating to watch those two films together. They were sort of pitted against each other at Sundance, but I think they're kind of complementary visions mm-hmm. and they get you thinking about different aspects of this very troubling case. So I think it's worth seeking out for sure.
Yeah, based on the true story of Christine Chubbuck, as you said, who was a broadcaster in Sarasota, Florida, mm-hmm. who took her own life on air. I saw Kate Plays Christine, the Robert Greene film, first, and then saw Christine about a week later. And I know everyone's going to be shocked to learn that the documentary that really takes chances with the form and is very meta and has the movie within the movie going on, this actress, Caitlin Scheel, plays Christine Chubbuck, but plays her as an actress, who she really is, mm-hmm. Caitlin Scheel, trying to figure out the role, basically trying to learn as much about her, do the research, and come to a place where she can play this part and she can try to understand Christine Chubbuck as best she can. That's the movie you would think I loved, but the fact is I'm pretty mixed on it, and I think that Christine is the far better film, and I think that Rebecca Hall is the reason why. It's really interesting to watch those two films back to back because, as I said, you see Caitlin Scheel struggling, as she should, to try to get in the mindset of this woman. And then somehow when you watch the Antonio Campos film and you see Hall, that movie doesn't make the mistake of trying to come up with easy answers for why she ends up the way she does. It's just all in the performance. It is all in Rebecca Hall's just natural disconnection from everyone around her. It really is something.
Yeah, it's interesting how the documentary fusses so much over the ethics of really just of depiction.
Right.
You know, and Christine just does it.
Mm-hmm.
They're different films. And I think, and to me, Kate Plays Christine is really about the craft of acting and breaking
down
the craft of
acting. And that's when it's most interesting, for sure.
As much as it is about the case. So, yeah. I'd recommend seeing them both, but I don't really have a preference, but I think Christine's a solid pick.
Thank you again, Ryan Johnson. We, of course, look forward to Star Wars Episode 8 from director Ryan Johnson next year. Let's get into our countdown. Josh, you are going to start us off. You're number 10.
All right, number 10. We're just getting started, obviously. It's very early, so maybe some of you will end up joining me in appreciating Jeff Nichols' Loving. So far, I have to say it's been largely left out of all the year-end acclaim, and I do think that the reason for that might be related to at least what resonated with me about the film, what was so good about it, and that is its aesthetic humility. This is neither showy in a, you know, hey, Oscar, look at me way that maybe the story would normally call for, but it's also not showy in a difficult, esoteric, hey, critic, look at me way. It's somewhere in between and is maybe getting lost because of that. What Loving does is takes this true story, and this is about the interracial couple whose 1958 marriage was upheld by the Supreme Court, and tells it through a series of very quiet, domestic, life-building moments. Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga play the Lovings, and Negga's just sublime. That's my favorite female performance of the year by far. And they portray this couple who stages a political revolution by just by insisting on their rights to, you know, iron the clothes, to mow the lawn. That's what they want to do. And their revolutionary act is to continue to do those things in the face of all this opposition. Obviously, there is legal machinations going on in the background on their behalf. And the movie does nod to that, but it's really rooted in their domesticity. So this was a weird year for director Jeff Nichols. I feel like we were looking forward to Midnight Special for so long. And when that came out, we both liked it quite a bit, mm-hmm. Adam, but it was sort of forgotten. I know, even though I know a lot of people who liked it, now Loving looks to almost have a similar fate, but you have to think that Nega at least will probably be getting notice and maybe Oscar attention eventually too.
You go to the Virginia State Court next, right?
Yes.
You nervous?
I suppose. Mm. The lawyers told us not to expect much.
You think you'll lose?
Well, yes. But I think it's all right. We may lose the small battles, but win the big war.
That was a movie reviewed on the show, but not with me. Was Michael Phillips the guest for that, or
that might have been the show we knocked out three reviews. It's been a blur lately.
Oh yeah, it was Michael. You talked about Arrival as well as part of that trio. I just caught up with this movie. I would have liked to have discussed it with you because, as you know, we were talking behind the scenes a little bit that we both agree this movie, maybe because it just seemed like such obvious Oscar bait. I get that, I suppose.
Yeah, the material certainly does.
Yeah, it seems to have been overlooked a little bit. And I'm with you completely on Ruth Negga, but I would also look at Joel Edgerton's performance in terms of, you talk about unshowy, subtlety, and playing a character who we're obviously rooting for is heroic in some ways because we want him to succeed. But at the same time, there are moments where he completely lets his wife take over and mm-hmm. Ruth Negga take control of the film. And he has no shyness, Joel Edgerton as an actor, about being second fiddle in those scenes.
Right.
He completely turns it over to her and doesn't try to sway us as audience members to be more sympathetic towards him at all. And I respect that.
No, not
that
at all. And I think is brave to the point of making this guy inarticulate
in
a way that could maybe be frustrating and certainly doesn't easily garner sympathy from an audience. I don't think anything in this movie is trying to do that, which is sort of a ironic risk to take, you know, mm-hmm. to be so unshowy.
I want to put the kitchen back, right back here.
Richard, stop this. I don't know what you're saying.
I bought it. This whole acre. I'm going to build you a house. Right here.
I kind of second everything you guys said, but I also want to jump on what you said about Joel Edgerton, because Jeff Nichols like released two movies this year that I really like. One of them may be on my list in a little bit, but I think kind of the biggest surprise he gave me this year was making me realize I really like Joel Edgerton as an mm-hmm. actor, because I thought he was really great in Midnight Special as well. And it was a very similar kind of understated background performance. And but that he can be so arresting in that kind of role mm-hmm. was just really took me by surprise when I saw it in Midnight Special, and Loving kind of cemented that affection for him.
Yeah, I mean, my take on Loving was that I felt like it could be a little more audacious than it was. The movie ended, and I thought it was good, but I also thought, okay, there that was Loving, and now I'm moving on to see something else.
But you don't think it's audacious, the fact that like we barely see the Supreme Court case that the movie is
ostensibly
about?
That's a bold choice, and it pays off.
It does. I mean, it makes good choices. And I actually saw a film just today called Hidden Figures that's set also in Virginia at a similar time, and I appreciated a little bit more Jeff Nichols' more subtle depiction of the time. It's mm-hmm. Hidden Figures is fine for what it is, but it's everything is much more broadly drawn. So,
yeah, I guess it was almost like this is what I wish all obvious Oscar films were really like.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
this
yeah,
one
okay.
It'd be
I
a better world.
There's a version of Loving that's like righteous and angry that is probably what you would think of as being the Oscar bait movie, and this is not that.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Scott, your number 10.
My number 10 is a film called Aquarius. This is a new film from a Brazilian director named Kleber Mendonca Filho, whose name I'm sure I just butchered. He made his debut with the excellent Neighboring Sounds a few years ago. It stars Sonia Braga in a career-capping performance as a 65-year-old music critic who's been living in the same Oceanside apartment for her entire adult life, and she refuses to sell it to these gentrifiers who have bought every other unit in the building. And as they're pressuring her to get rid of this property, the film continues to flash back to various memories and moments in her life that really give meaning to that space. And it's a rich, evocative, moving film, and with an excellent soundtrack and a great, you know, sense of community, which is what Neighboring Sounds was all about as well. Real gem. And I think there was a lot of surprise that Sonia Braga did not end up taking Best Actress at Cannes for this role, which she richly deserves, I think.
It's fitting, I suppose, that Neighboring Sounds is one of my big regrets of 2012, and I still haven't caught up with it as we were taping that year-end roundtable, and here Aquarius, yeah, one of those as well for me that I haven't seen. I can always count on you, Scott, to come in and shame me a little bit, and that's good.
And the films they echo each other in really interesting ways. And this is a little more accessible, too. I think Neighboring Sounds is a little more high art than Aquarius. Aquarius, I think, people can get into pretty easily.
Genevieve, we're ready for your number 10 film of the year.
All right. Well, I'll just start by saying my number 10 is a bit of a cheat. It probably would not actually be my number 10 of the year, but I just needed to get some love for what I think is the funniest comedy of the year that also happens to function as an original musical. And that movie is Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping.
Yes, love thank it. You.
A snow white dove in the pitch black night. A raindrop falls from tremendous heights. A wave crashes off of a cliff in Scotland. A child bites an apple, but the core is rotten. TV is free, but what is the cost? We had GPS, and yet we're still lost. A carrot in the desert, a camel in the garden. A man with giant ears begging your pardon. What if a garbage man was actually smart? A common misconception that we're tearing apart into a dog. Dog food is just food.
This is a movie from The Lonely Island, the musical spoofers who made their name on Saturday Night Live. And it's such a funny movie, guys. Like, this one was really buried in theaters, but seeing it with you, I believe, Scott, and our Next Picture Show co-host Tasha Robinson, is one of my most memorable theatrical experiences of the year, because I don't think we stopped laughing for the full runtime of this movie. And it was just continuous laughter in the movie. But beyond that, I don't think that Akiva Schaffer and Jorma Taccone, who are two members of The Lonely Island, who are the directors here, I don't think they get enough credit for what great stylistic mimics they are. Mm-hmm. We've seen that in The Lonely Island's music videos over the years, but seeing it stretched out to feature length in Pop Star is, I think, pretty impressive, the way that they were able to replicate the look and feel and tone of that sort of modern MTV-produced strain of pop concert documentary, but on a obviously much lower budget with fewer resources. And it's such a fun film. Its humor is like more like machine gun than sniper. It's just like throwing joke after visual gag after joke after visual gag at you. But the hit to miss ratio, I think, is seriously impressive in this movie.
Listen to this, homies. We can upload your entire album to fridges, washer dryers, blenders, and microwaves across the country.
You can do that?
Yes, nerd. It's just Wi-Fi jibber jabber. It's not a big deal.
This is that next, man. I told y'all, Deborah's a genius.
It's true. And it is also pronounced Deborah.
Deborah. Oh, that's very cool. What's the origin of that?
I believe Deborah.
I'm so glad you put this on. I wanted to find a way for this to get on my list and just couldn't honestly do it. But
there.
You went there, and it's a great pick. I think it's also, you're right. I think of this as a great year for movie musicals, which we'll probably get into more. And I wasn't even thinking of Pop Star, but it's absolutely one. Yeah.
I'm similarly stoked that this was on the list. There's like a handful of Hollywood films or little under the radar things that didn't do all that well in theaters that I think people are going to discover and just watch over and over and over again on video or whatever the modern equivalent of video is. And I think Pop Star is one of them because, it's full of laughs and it really replicates the Lonely Island video experience beautifully. It blows it up and you don't feel like it's stretching itself too thin. And I loved it.
I'm really glad you gave the filmmakers credit for making a real film here, because that's what it is. I think they probably could have gotten by on just stringing together these gags because they're very strong and they're very funny. My favorite line in the film has to be, and is it Sarah Silverman? Is she his assistant? And Sandberg or publicist, plays a publicist character. Yeah. And Sandberg at this point is hit really hard times and he's out at a bar and he still thinks he needs to disguise himself from the public. And of course, this plays much better when you can see the getup he has on his face and what he's wearing. But she says to him, "You look like Nazi propaganda." And I lost it. I laughed probably for about 2 minutes at Popstar. So thank you, Genevieve, for letting me relive that moment here by putting it on your list.
Gladly.
If you'll indulge me, just a little bit of a preamble here before I get to my number 10. If you've heard past top 10 shows, you know with my list, often a common theme emerges. And that's true this year, maybe more blatantly, maybe more thoroughly than in any other year. I want to leave discussion of that theme for part two of the show, though it is something I did mention briefly when we did our Golden Brick preview special in November, so it's not a big secret, but we'll see if listeners maybe pick up on any recurring threads throughout my first five choices here. But in terms of how I settled on these 10 films, we were having another conversation behind the scenes here, Josh, as we do with our wonderful producer, Sam Van Hallgren, and I'm not going to mention the director we were talking about by name because I don't want such a misguided sentiment floating out into the world, but Sam said this filmmaker can do moments, not movies. I don't want to suggest that moments are everything because, of course, there are plenty of mediocre to terrible movies that have some wonderful individual moments and scenes. But I think they're close for me because when I was going through this process and I was forcing myself to rank which movies belonged on this top 10 list, it was the extraordinary moments from those movies that hounded me, that were begging to be relived and reconsidered. So basically, if I thought of a scene and instantly I could tap into how it made me feel as I watched that scene unfold, that visceral reaction, whether it's joy or sadness or fury or empathy or wonder, whatever, those films were contenders. The other thing for me that I considered is these 10 movies also exhibit an element of the miraculous for me. Maybe it's appropriate to use that word this time of year. That's the only way I can describe it. The artists involved in these movies and creating these movies, they made really bold choices. They took risky chances and somehow they didn't just pay off. They didn't just work, but they transcended. So with all that said, how can I talk about miracles and not lead with a movie about the Miracle on the Hudson? I'm going there. I'm going there.
Oh, man.
Clint Eastwood's Sully is my number 10 film of the year. And the real miracle, frankly, here is that I'm sitting here further exalting a movie that I really had no interest in seeing whatsoever, made by a filmmaker whose work I found uneven. 1992 Unforgiven, that's Eastwood's last masterpiece. Letters from Iwo Jima in, I think, 2006 was his last film that made one of my top 10 lists. It was also the last film of his that even contended for one of my top 10 lists. But I think it's the structure of Sully that elevates it beyond your usual based on true events story of heroism. Eastwood and the screenwriter here, his name's Todd Komornicki. They open the movie with the flight. It begins the way you suspect that flight actually maybe did, nothing out of the ordinary, until the plane crashes right into the heart of Manhattan. Sully wakes up. It was a nightmare, actually, of what might have happened. And then 30 minutes in, we see this play out again in more detail. This time it's for real, but it shifts to the perspective of the air traffic controllers and the Port Authority and the Coast Guard gearing up for the rescue. And we get back on the plane a little bit, but we stay out of the cockpit mostly, and we see the flight attendants going through their protocols. And that's one of those key moments of this film for me, is when we see them saying, brace, 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 heads down, stay down. There's evident fear, which of course would be unavoidable in that moment, but it's overridden by their training. Something about that certainly resonated with me. And then the NTSB showdown at the end, Josh, which I know you didn't appreciate, where we see some of the events we've already witnessed.
Just give me one version of this, not four like the
movie
does.
See, that's where you're so misguided. We get some new perspectives and we watch the various simulations play out. And I do think it's a valid, if ultimately unimaginative, criticism to find this part of the movie really redundant. We do see a lot of variations of the same thing. But I guess for me, this is a very 2016 movie in that every angle and perspective and detail is crucial, since the whole movie is about trying to zero in on a concrete truth concerning an event that's a quagmire of data and emotion and politics and human fallibility. So that also resonated with me. And I really appreciate the fact that it's a movie about a heroic act that doesn't just bother to show, but devotes real attention to all of the people who made it a heroic act and not a tragedy. And I'm going to need a little extra support here because I'm getting the vibe from the room that you guys aren't on board with what I'm selling at all. So Manola Dargis, She says this in her review: Mr. Eastwood's filmmaking is expedient, detailed, and distinguished by sudden beauty, as when Sully, after the accident, stands alone while framed against the wintry, lead-gray sky out of which he just fell. Great scene. Mr. Eastwood is a musician, and he plays with the story's competing moods and rhythms with suppleness, setting one scene to the steady beat of everyday life, only to amp another until it races like a thudding heart. And I'll also add, David Bordwell wrote a great piece on his website breaking down Eastwood's use of replays and repetition techniques and just talking about him as a classical filmmaker as well, if you need a little more to encourage you to see this film or appreciate this film. I did, and you have that chance now because it just came out on DVD and iTunes this week.
Well, I'm going to give you another card to play. It's one I've used before, the Richard Brody card. Okay, when I've been all alone on a movie on my top 10 list, I've turned to him. I forget which film it was in the last few years, but he's got Sully on there too.
Number four.
So yeah, I think, you know, number three, Adam. So
oh, is
you're,
it?
I'm afraid you're underrating Sully in the end.
I might
when
be.
When it's all said and done.
I might be.
All right. Bravo to you for sticking to your guns.
I am.
Number nine for me. Actually, let's let longtime listener Josh Youngerman set up my number nine pick, which we both share.
This is Joshua Youngerman in Bushwick, Brooklyn. My number one film is Marin Odd's Tony Erdmann, which is a delightful three-hour screwball comedy. It's the quickest 3 hours I've spent in the cinema all year. And I think it's also a very topical film about globalization, trade, free trade, and socialism, while containing two all-timers when it comes to comic set pieces. So thank you very much. And I hope you guys have a great new year.
So screwball comedy, Tony Erdmann certainly is, but very slyly so. It didn't fully register to me as a screwball comedy, I think, until it was almost over, or maybe even after the fact, where I thought, you know what, that was really funny. I think for most of this movie, I had no idea what I was watching or what to expect from scene to scene or how this relationship was going to play out, the central relationship between this goofball father and his corporate-minded adult daughter. But I was transfixed. I just couldn't look away from it. No other movie this year, I think, had me so unsure of what was going to happen as it unspooled. The director is Marin Ade, and the two leads are Sandra Hüller and Peter Simonischek. They're both wonderful in these parts. There's awkwardness and there's tension and there's genuine emotion, and all of those elements slowly build as this movie goes on, especially as the father's antics get crazier, talking about the alter ego that Andy Samberg wears in Popstar. That's nothing compared to what the father wears here when he becomes Tony Erdmann. He puts on this wild wig, this fake buck teeth, and then he insinuates himself into his daughter's life by pretending to be this business consultant. Mm-hmm. She, and this is a long movie and a lot more happens after this, so I'm not giving too much away to say that she essentially calls his bluff and brings him into the fold to say, all right, you're going to do this. I'm going to let you, and let's see where this goes. So this leads to some remarkable scenes. I'm pretty sure I have a good guess at the two that Josh is thinking of.
For sure.
They're cringe-inducing. They're weirdly moving. The movie's kind of like a cringe hug. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's
all I give.
It's sort of what Tony Erdmann is, and it was a remarkable experience. Hmm.
It's going to be much higher on my my list, so I do appreciate it. But I think there is a journey that's being taken here, almost to freedom in a way, a journey towards liberation in the film that both the characters go on and the film itself as it gets more and more unhinged, and then you land at these scenes toward the end that are just so brilliant and inspired. And yeah, this film's a real epic.
Yeah, did not make my top 10, so I will add that I do think it's a pretty remarkable film. I think it's its own type of miracle for sure, because you just don't really know what you're watching and it is constantly surprising you. I think my favorite little touches are watching the father, because he always is carrying those fake teeth, just always ready to break into character, and he'll have them in and then he might sit down for a moment. He'll have some kind of awkward encounter, or maybe things just don't go the way you wanted him to, and he'll take them out for a second, like, oh, you know, I gotta cast aside these childish games, and then 5 seconds later, they're back in his mouth. Like he just
like
can't help himself.
It's a pacifier. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Scott, your number nine.
My number nine is L by Paul Verhoeven. Paul Verhoeven has spent a career contemplating the human potential for atrocity in films as diverse as Soldier of Orange, Starship Troopers, and Black Book. And L continues in that provocative tradition. There's nothing simple about this rape revenge story, nothing timid about it either. It reminds me a little bit, it's kind of like the Chirac of this year. It's another case of an old provocateur barreling into a sensitive conversation with as much candor as possible. You know, it's a messy film. It's occasionally quite objectionable. It's frequently brilliant, and it's all held together by Isabel Huppert. You know, he was going to make this film in English in America. I just can't imagine it without Huppert. But it's just such a troubled film and a witty film and something that it's a conversation starter. And I'm getting some.
What kind of conversation?
Yeah, I was
going to
say even if it ends with someone throwing a drink in your face,
probably
maybe a
so.
Slap.
That's true. It is. It could be a contentious conversation, but so same with that Chirac. It's just You know, I like its boldness, and that was kind of a marker for me this year in terms of films that made my list and didn't make my list. It's just like how much of a chance do you take? Which is I guess true of you as well. I mean, it took a whole lot of restraint for me to not put the Neon Demon on my top 10.
Oh, we'll get there.
I'm excited. but that's sort of the spirit I was going for, just really films that go out far on a limb. And, you know, and I think in the context of Paul Verhoeven's career, it's fascinating. And he's clearly a guy who's not going to go quietly into that good night. So
I talked about L just for a little bit on our last episode. I'm more mixed on the film than you. And this is an unfair question because it would require you to get into details that we're not going to share with our audience. And yet you're a pro, so I'm going to hit you with it anyway.
Okay.
Unlike Chirac, I think that's a great comparison, both really bold, provocative films. I don't know that Chirac opens itself up to a variety of different interpretations the way that L does. I think there are ways to view that film potentially where you can go down a rabbit hole of completely unspooling everything that happens and looking at it through a different prism. Did you have any type of experience like that with this movie, or do you see it as pretty straightforward?
Well, I don't see that as a negative.
No, I don't either.
I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it.
In fact, that's why it's gotten better in my mind over time.
The discomfort that the film inspires is, I mean, it's a very, very Verhoeven thing, and I'm happy with that.
Okay. Genevieve.
All right. My number nine was kind of my first big movie surprise of the year, and it stuck with me. That's 10 Cloverfield Lane, which I believe I submitted as my pick for your mid-year show. And yeah, it's sitting at number nine for me. It's just a masterclass in building suspense through atmosphere. Just the sense of unease and claustrophobia that Dan Trachtenberg builds just simply through framing and sound design and some really great performances. It's right out of the Hitchcock handbook, and it really serves to kind of underscore the more mysterious elements of the plot. I think the fact that John Goodman is not in the discussion for best performances this year is a shame. Perhaps just it happened too early in the year, or I don't know what. And I think Mary Elizabeth Winstead and John Gallagher Jr. keep pace with him as this kind of the central trio holding this movie together.
How's that sauce?
Fine.
As cooks go, I'm okay. Not great, but okay. Megan was a good cook. You'll learn to love cooking.
It's delicious. It's the best sauce I've ever tasted.
Are you being funny?
No, I mean, considering the alternative, which is, you know, getting burnt up in a chemical attack or nuclear, I'd say being alive and down here would make a fried turd taste pretty good, so. Best damn sauce I ever had.
That's not a bad point. And please, watch your language at table.
I love it. It's one I've revisited a couple times throughout the year and still love it.
Yeah, I'm with you on those performances, especially Mary Elizabeth Winstead. I think the only reason she's not among my top five when I submitted various ballots for the year is just because there are so many good lead actress options this year, but she was certainly in the top 10. I think she's the glue that holds that movie together as things get a little more intense and crazy, but John Goodman's certainly there to to ground that intensity and craziness.
And amplify it.
And amplify it. She's genius.
She's basically the Janet Leigh, but Janet Leigh who continues to live past the first third of half of the movie. Yeah. I also liked, too, just how it defied expectations just as a film, because this had Cloverfield in the title. I mean, it was released in with the same amount of sneakiness and viral marketing. And it was nice to see a kind of classically constructed thriller rather than a bunch of people carrying digital cameras around.
Well, it also serves as a counterpoint, I think, to what we were talking about at the top with the top 10 box office films. This is very much a studio product that does enter into that reheat category, whether you call it a sideways sequel or whatever, but from a completely different direction, and surprises us as we're watching it, as we've said. I don't recall how well it did. I mean, is this something that was rewarded for taking those chances, or is it something that's kind of just, you know, middle ground and instead they're going to crank out another DC comic because that made more money, even though it was less well received?
I'm going to say however it performed, it does deserve more viewers. So maybe we can send a few more Dan Trachtenberg's way. My number nine, if you want a look inside my fractured psyche this time of year, and I don't know why you would, frankly, but I'm going to give it to you. My number nine movie is at number nine, despite the fact that when this whole top 10 process started, it was higher on my list. And earlier today, I had actually decided to bump it from my list completely and slide another movie up into its place. And when you guys do eventually hear what movie was going to take its spot, my guess is that at least Genevieve and Scott will be really disappointed. We'll see. But for now, La La Land stays in the picture. I almost removed it because I just found, as I was trying to make my case for these movies, I was somehow lacking the conviction. The fervor just wasn't there as it was for the other picks. And this is what I did have, though. Talking about miracles, I suppose you have to give Damien Chazelle some credit for pulling off a modern musical so beautifully. That's bold. We obviously don't see these types of films every day. And while there is some good stuff in between, the intricacy and the exuberance of that opening sequence on the expressway is breathtaking. And I think the closing sequence, the audacity of that is also pretty magical. I do think as well there's a pretty great scene. Key non-musical scene. We argued about this a little bit, Josh, during our review, a confrontation between Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, the two lovers at the center of this film, that I think is absolutely believable in its trajectory, going from this kind of romantic bliss to really stunned anger and frustration and silence. And I will say real quick that after we talked about it and you stepped out and Michael Phillips came on for the last part of the show, I was telling him about our review and how it went and some of the things we disagreed on. And all I said was the dinner scene. And before I could even get the rest of my sentence out, Philip said, totally plausible, great scene. So Michael's on my side, Josh. Sorry about that. I will also give it this. I'm here making the case for the movie that I am also trying to make the case that I almost knocked out of its slot. It is the movie of 2016 I most can't wait to see for a second time. And on the big screen, where I can fully appreciate the spectacle, and I haven't had that opportunity yet. So all of that was almost but not quite enough to guarantee La La got the part. And then at the 11th hour, who should call in? Who should swoop in but Tasha Robinson?
Hi, guys. Tasha Robinson from The Verge and Film Spotting's sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, calling in with my number one of 2016. I've probably written more about La La Land than any other film this year because it's been so endlessly fascinating to me. I've interviewed the director, Damien Chazelle. I've interviewed the choreographer, Mandy Moore. I've written about why it won't work for a certain kind of film goer and why it works so well for those of us who love musicals and love cinema and feel just a little swoony when people on screen burst into song or dance. And all that's because, just as with Chazelle's previous film, Whiplash, there is so much thought and talent and intent and focus packed into this little L.A. love story about two people clumsily pursuing their artistic dreams. The things that make La La Land the best movie of the year for me have very little to do with the performances of the stars, Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. It's really all about how well Chazelle and Moore evoke old Hollywood and the hunger for fame and the hunger for love and the conflict between the real world and the innocent, nostalgic, colorful past we all have collectively in our heads from a lifetime of watching movies together. So I'm going to echo Justin Hurwitz's song from the soundtrack on this one and say, here's to the ones who dream. La La Land is very aware that it's pure cinema magic, made by dreamers for dreamers, and I could not possibly love it more.
So guys, your colleagues, certainly Film Spotting listeners, are familiar with Tasha. They've heard her many times over the years on the show. And I know it's frustrating, Scott, especially for you, it seems, on occasion. Mm-hmm. She is very wrong sometimes. I recall your discussion on the Next Picture Show, episode 1 and 2, I think, about All the President's Men and Spotlight. And her take on the ending of All the President's Men is just bonkers. But you know what? When she's on, and she's persuasive. And she persuaded me to keep La La Land on my list.
Problem with Tasha is that she's really persuasive even when she is wrong.
Tasha actually just made me think I'm wrong, because La La Land is kind of nowhere near my top 10. It was a movie I enjoyed in the moment, but kind of fell out of my brain moments after it finished. And it may be one that I need to see again on the big screen to fully appreciate. But hearing her, you know, describe what she liked about the film, and like, Tasha and I, our tastes align more often than not. And I love musical theater, and I like movies about movies and cinema. And but I think what really was the sticking point for me was those central performances, which even she says are like not the focus of the movie. They just really drain a lot of the energy out of La La Land for me.
Well, I'll throw out to that point, Michael Phillips, probably to the chagrin of a lot of people out there who do love this movie and love Ryan Gosling, he's actually not enamored at all with his performance. He thinks Emma Stone really just acts him under the table. And his point, and I do think there's some validity to what he's saying here, even though I like his performance overall better, he says it's all neck down for Ryan Gosling, but it's not on his face. Whereas Emma Stone in these scenes, you see her performing with her entire body. And Ryan Gosling does just kind of give you that sense of, I'm very precise, I'm knocking this out, I'm great to look at on screen, but maybe there just isn't that connection to the material.
Except for the dance scenes, you know, he uses a little bit of his body there, and I think
the body, but not his face, is Michael's point.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, and I think, you know, maybe that's partly also, this is Emma Stone's movie. I mean, as egalitarian as I feel it is in terms of the structure and the screenplay and the narrative, she just runs away with this thing. And for me, it's a joy to watch. I mean, this is fun, guys, but I wish I was watching La La Land right now. I'm sorry. So we'll obviously I'll talk about that a little bit more.
It's
as
interesting
we get going.
You say that about her because, of course, one of the other points we disagree on is I feel like it could have been her movie, but Giselle is so clearly more interested in the artistry and professionalism of Ryan Gosling's character. And I don't think it's balanced out.
Yeah. Not when she gets the opening number, she gets the closing powerhouse audition number. I mean, she just brings this
thing audition
home.
Scene actually is not one that stays with me at all from that film.
I just that think first number?
No, not the one that's her big audition
that
scene later in the film.
Oh, okay.
I just think the characterization is so much flatter for her character. I agree that she does give a better performance, but I think the character is underwritten.
Well, when you think, I think it's especially interesting when you compare this to, as I did in our review, the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers films that it's modeled on. It's funny to me how we are unable sometimes to look at the form that this movie is within and consider it to the standards we might put pictures like that, which are many of them considered Hollywood classics, and their characters are often thinner than, you know, what we get in La La Land. So just because it might not meet our modern standards of what a romantic comedy might be or even a romantic drama in terms of characterization shouldn't necessarily be a knock against it when it's operating in a completely different form. But I'm partly getting ahead of myself here, and I think we need to take a quick breather even though we're only a few picks in. So when we return, we're going to have the results of the Film Spotting poll. We asked listeners which 2016 movie they liked best among those that Adam and I gave some love to on the show.
Of course, we will give some more love to our 8 through 6 picks here on this top 10 end of year roundtable. It's a tradition here on these shows to ask friend of the show, Sam Smith, to pick a couple of his favorite pieces of film music from the year. He's a musician, he's a designer, he's the host of the Poster Boys podcast, which is devoted to talk about movie poster art and features interviews with poster artists. He's also got a gig talking about movie soundtracks on the radio in Nashville on WXNA. It's called OSTFM. We will link to both of those shows in the notes for this show over at filmspotting.net. His first pick comes from Johan Johansson's score for Arrival, Heptapod B. But before we play that, we do have a voicemail from Sam. He gave us his pick for number one film of the year and number one movie poster of the year.
Hey guys, it's Sam Smith calling, and my favorite film of the year is Kirsten Johnson's Camera Person. beautiful portrait of humanity, and specifically human suffering. I think it's something we need to be humbled by more often. So it really blew me away. And my favorite poster of the year, by the way, is Anthony Juras for Janus Films' restoration of Kieslowski's The Decalogue. Thanks, guys, and Merry Christmas, Happy New Year.
Adam and Josh, Ben Haworth from North Hollywood, California, calling in for my number one film of 2016, which is J.A. Bayona's masterpiece, A Monster Calls. In a year where so many great films were about storytelling, A Monster Calls stands above the rest, reinterpreting the classic fairy tale myth in order to get at one of the hardest fundamental truths about grief. In a year where CGI brought us so much misery, Bayona uses it to create one of the great new movie creatures, and remind us that storytelling is just as important as visual splendor. This film is fantastic. It made me cry a dozen times. It's maybe the best film about letting go of or made. It ruined a time on the clock for me, and yet everyone seemed to just dismiss it with a shrug. What a shame. But hopefully I can urge some of you out there to seek out this fantastic film.
Thanks to Ben Haworth for that great voicemail. We will get back to our own picks for the best films of the year in a moment. We are two selections in. We have three more to share with you on part one here of our roundtable, but we have a little business first, including for our Chicago area listeners, a chance to see Ben Haworth's number one movie of 2016, A Monster Calls. We have run of engagement free passes to give away for that. You can enter now at filmspotting.net. Josh, do you think this movie, because I know you just saw it, was unfairly dismissed?
You know, I think it suffers in comparison to the BFG, which I wouldn't say was necessarily all that great itself, but I think they're both interesting films. There are definitely things in both of them to recommend, you know, far away from a masterpiece for me, but I think it does deserve attention. He's right about, and this comes at the end, in what it recognizes in terms of grief and how it acknowledges this young boy processing that. And a number of year-end films have taken on the subject of grief and done so delicately. He's right, despite the CGI and some other elements you wouldn't associate with that sort of tenderness, A Monster Calls does manage to hit upon that.
Well, you can see who is more right about A Monster Calls. Give it some attention yourself as it is now playing here in Chicago. And again, we have some run of engagement passes to give away over at our website. We are also giving away some run of engagement passes to my number nine film of the year, La La Land. You also have the chance to win a 45 record. Remember 45 records, everybody?
I've got a pile in my closet.
That 45 includes tracks from the La La Land soundtrack. Again, that's also over at filmspotting.net.
Also, we want to remind everyone, this isn't the end. This show, nor our follow-up show, will be the end of celebrating the year in film that was 2016. We're going to do it in a completely different way, live, in front of a live audience, and we hope you can join us on Friday, January 13. It's for our wrap party. So we've already talked about the best films of the year at that point. We talked about best performances and things like that on an episode, one episode ago, I think it was. So this is a chance to get into some of the more nitty-gritty, some of the details, some of the actual scenes, the moving moments, the scene of the year we hit at the end, which is always fun. And we project these on a screen so you get to watch them alongside with us. We'll have a ton of special guests who are joining us for some of these categories. And it really is a highlight for me for Film Spotting. So come on out January 13. We're going to be in Hyde Park this year on the city's south side at the University of Chicago's Logan Center for the Arts. And you can get all the details for that at filmspotting.net.
Yeah, it's a beautiful venue. We hope to see you there. Tickets are on sale now. We didn't have space over these episodes, Josh, for a donation segment, but I did really quickly want to acknowledge the great generosity of listeners here at the end of the year. And of course, all year round, listener contributions really help us keep doing what we're doing. And one name I wanted to highlight here because it was a Christmas gift, Connor Tulaney. I believe he's still in Austin, Texas. PayPal has decided to stop showing where people are sending their donations from. He sent a donation on behalf of Virginia Tulaney. It's the third year in a row he's done that. So Connor is either the worst Christmas shopper of all time, or he's incredibly, incredibly thoughtful. I'm going with the latter.
Yeah, I would say time to mix it up, Connor, but nah, keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you, Connor and Virginia and everyone else who supported us this year.
Hey, Film Spotting Nation. It is me, Peter Labuza from LAIS, the Village Voice and the Cinephilex podcast, calling in with my favorite film of 2016. And I've got a tie this year between two documentaries, OJ Made in America and Camera Person. In Camera Person, you get these parts of documentaries that were supposed to be scraps, and Kristen Johnson kind of turns them into both this global portrait of humanity and crises, but always makes us consider how the form itself can speak to just the person holding the camera. I think this really powerful portrait. And then OJ Made in America, Ezra Edelman, he might not be reinventing the wheel formally, but he uses what are the most essential parts of documentary, interviews, archival footage, and editing to weave this harrowing tale of race relations and celebrity in the late 20th century, and uses the length to really make that point count. I think these documentaries give me hope that nonfiction is going to remain increasingly relevant, formally playful, and essential as cinema continues to evolve. So thanks for another fun year. I'll talk to you guys in 2017.
Camera Person is the one I share with Peter here as we get back into our list. We are at number 8 on our countdown. And I like his observation about how the documentary explores how the form itself can speak to the person holding the camera. This is a very personal film, but in a different way than I think so many first-person documentaries are. Many of those that I've seen can have somewhat of a familiar format to them and function. And this does so many different things. Among the footage here are scenes of Kirsten Johnson, the director, with her mother, who's suffering from Alzheimer's the first time that we see her, and she's died by the time we reach the film's second half. Now, Johnson and her collaborators use montage and artful editing so that these mother-daughter sequences, they're not only elegantly connected to some of the other footage, which seemingly random footage that we see, including this wonderful mother-child moment with a boxer that comes later on, but these sequences of Johnson and her mother, they're also connected with the movie's larger ideas about how filmmakers might depict great suffering with dignity. That's, you know, the ultimate subject that the movie does find its way to by the end. So I expected Camera Person to be a really interesting exploration of film form and documentary form, but I never thought that it could be as moving as it was as well.
Who's this guy? Who's that guy?
That's who I married.
That's who you married?
Uh-huh.
Who is he to me?
You know him too?
I know him too. I've known him all my life.
No kidding.
Yeah, I'm serious.
And look, here's me. It's a teeny tiny baby.
Yeah, ironically, you swooned for it more than I did, and I'm the guy that really tends to go for these types of films that are about that act of creation and really about movie making, but it is for me one of those films. I don't think it's going to come up again on our list, so want to give it even a little bit more love now. It's certainly in my 11 through 20, maybe even in my top 15. And I think I've said this on the show, but you have to give it about 30 or 35 minutes to really have it click,
yeah.
I think.
And where it coalesces.
For a while, yeah, it coalesces. That's the perfect word. You feel like you're watching just a random assortment of scenes, and then at some point you recognize that there really is something much deeper going on in that film.
But I like those early scenes for the way that they kind of evoke the quality of memory, mm-hmm. and the nonlinear aspect of it. And yeah, this movie was very close to my top 10 as well. And it's just formally so interesting in the way it creates emotion and narrative almost, I don't want to say beside itself, but when you're not, in ways you're not expecting and not prepared for.
And to your point, Johnson identifies it as a memoir at, mm-hmm. at the top. So that's clearly how she has kind of processed it and formed it.
Well, just that bold choice up front to not have any voiceover, to not have, I think, the expected connective tissue that's going to bring all this B-roll footage together is important, and also is reflective of her priorities and interests as an artist and filmmaker. She's traveled the world, and she likes to, and she's interested in global crises, and she's interested in, you know, ethnography and empathy. And there's just there's something also just about the camera and what the, you know, we're conscious of the camera and what role the camera can play in forging relationships, which is great.
There are many scenes like this we could single out, but the one for me that I tell people about who will never see this movie is the one where she is visiting a country that has been a war-torn place. I think maybe she's visiting it a few years after she even originally filmed there. And they're at this home that's essentially kind of a cabin, and there's children who are near wood chopping.
I don't know how else to say it, but
so Kirsten Johnson is behind the camera. She seems maybe 10 or 15 feet away from a little boy, maybe two or three at the most, and he's by this block of wood, a stump of a tree kind of thing, and there's a little pickaxe in it. Well, it's not that little, actually.
No,
there's
an axe
in it.
Wood chopping axe.
He could carry it if it somehow got in his hand. But that's not going to happen because it's stuck in the wood until his big brother comes along and takes it out of the wood and gives it to him. And we just watch as this little kid plays with this thing. And you can actually, if you listen closely, you can hear Kirsten Johnson behind the camera making little sounds, breathing. Yeah. She's wanting, it seems, to jump in or to somehow prevent the accident that we all think is surely about to happen. But the key is she doesn't, does she? She's behind the camera and she doesn't even say, by the way, does anyone want to take a look at this? She lets the scene play out.
Which, you know, of course, is one level of suspense and tension, but it also speaks to the connectivity that the whole picture has, because so much of this is about what is your involvement with what the camera is capturing. So that's a very explicit example of something that the whole movie explores.
Yeah, and I love watching over the course of that film how it starts with us just getting a sense of her behind the camera in little bits like that, hearing things, seeing her jiggle the camera, hearing her breathe. But as it goes on, we meet her children, we meet her parents, we do eventually get the camera turned on her. It really does turn into that personal memoir. Scott, your number eight film of the year.
My number eight is Jackie. And this is, I hesitate to call it a biopic, but for the purposes of the discussion, I will. It's formally audacious in every way, from the close-up style to the multiple framing devices to Mika Levi's just incredible score. But what stays with me is the intimacy with which director Pablo Larraine shows us Jackie Kennedy's situation. I was reminded of Hillary Clinton's much derided line about politicians needing a public and a private position. And this is essentially Jackie's situation after her husband's assassination. You know, she's in total shock over the violent death of her husband, for whom she had very complicated feelings, but she's completely present for an important political moment because there has to be this peaceful transition of power. And her managing the aftermath so shrewdly in that bloodstained pink Chanel suit, it's just an image that will stay with me for a long time. I mean, this film just completely transformed whatever I thought of Jackie Kennedy going into it. I just love it.
You'll have to share something personal eventually. People won't stop asking until you do.
And if I don't, they'll interpret my silence however they want. Her brow furrows. Her lips are drawn. She holds back her tears, but she can't hide her anger.
Most writers want to be famous.
You want to be famous?
No, I am fine as I am, thank you.
You should prepare yourself. This article will bring you a great deal of attention.
Oh, in that case, any advice for me?
Yes. Don't marry the president.
Yeah, this is one I managed to just see over the weekend, and largely because of all the attention it got from the Chicago Film Critics. We mentioned that, Adam, on a previous show, and knowing that you liked it too, Scott. And it struck me as you were saying, is it a biopic or not? It struck me as a psychodrama. I mean, those close-ups that you're mentioning, the Levy score that has gotten a lot of acclaim and deservedly so, that puts you off balance. It made me think of Portman's Black Swan more than anything else, which is not what I at all expected.
The way
going
the camera
in.
Follows Jackie through the halls of the White House.
There's even some Shining
It's elephant is what it is. Now that I think about it, it's Van Sant's elephant. The way the camera is keeping her in the middle of the frame and following her around the way.
And that disjointed quality to the editing as it follows her. There's that great sequence where we see her over the course of maybe a few hours, could be a few days, in different outfits. Everything about the production design of this film, the sound design, and the cinematography and the editing really wowed me, and maybe it was a little bit of overload because I didn't have as strong of a reaction to it overall, Scott, as you did. But you are not alone in your love for this film. We have another guest voicemailer.
Hi, this is Katie Rich of VanityFair.com and the Little Gold Men and Fighting in the War Room podcast. And the best film of 2016 is Pablo Larraín's Jackie. It is not the portrait of female power in the White House we thought we were going to get this year, but I think it's all the more interesting film for it. It's got this great anchoring performance from Natalie Portman, and then this surreal atmosphere around it that indicates what happens when a woman is put into a position she didn't expect and is leading in a way that no one really wanted her to. It's been a really interesting year for film. I had a baby this year, so I'm still catching up, but I doubt I will see anything as moving, as fascinating, and as interesting as Jackie. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you, Katie, and congratulations. Obviously, echoing some of your thoughts there, Scott, on Jackie. Just a few days ago, we got an email from a listener correcting me on how to properly say Pablo Larraín's last name.
Let's hear it.
Hint, it's not Larraín, and it's especially not Larraín because it's supposed to have the rolling R's.
Yeah, I'm waiting for this.
I took Spanish in high school. Never could do it. I should have had my daughter Sophie. If Sophie was here, oh my goodness, she's amazing at it. She's a natural.
Sophie voicemail.
You're not going to get it from me. Genevieve, who can't roll her R's, but you can tell us your number 8 film of 2016.
My number 8 is American Honey, Andrea Arnold's bold, beautiful road trip through Red State America in a crowded van with a bunch of rude, crude young people selling magazine subscriptions to unsuspecting dupes. I'm a sucker for stories about girls and young women discovering themselves, as I think you will see as we continue through this list. And this film certainly qualifies as that. Earlier, we had that call from Josh where he said that Tony Erdman was the quickest 3 hours he'd spent in a theater. That's how I felt about American Honey. It's a long movie that just kind of washed over me in the most pleasurable sensation, even though it is not necessarily a soothing film. But I think it makes a lot of really interesting and subtle observations about how young people interact with each other. And I was really captivated by this movie's view of both of poor rural America and of sort of teenage abandon, that feeling when you kind of have nothing left to lose and you're invincible. Andrea Arnold treads this really interesting line between kind of an almost anthropological observation and these very humanistic character-based moments.
It just takes one step. Once you get this one step down, you're the chief of the tribe. And I'm going to teach you that one step today. You know what I'm saying? Basically, as soon as they open that door and look at you, that's the critical moment. That's the make or break moment. Because in that second, you got to work them. You got to read them. You got to be able to scan them and figure them out, figure out what kind of person that person wants in their life. Then you got to be that person, you know? It's like couple of the other ages really
I really adored this movie. I love the central character of this movie, whose name's Star. She's played by newcomer Sasha Lane. And Lane's performance is admittedly a little rough around the edges, but I think her general kind of presence and charisma, which are sort of buttressed by a very good Shia LaBeouf in this film, kind of go a long way to what makes this movie so captivating for me.
I think one of your best episodes on the Next Picture Show this year was comparing American Honey to My Own Private Idaho. And unfortunately, I've got to fall on the other side of that great debate. And this is one that, you know, at the beginning of the year, I would maybe have pigeonholed as likely to have a top 10 slot, loving Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights and just being intrigued by the story. And I'm still honestly wrestling with my resistance to it. I think it is the Lane performance a little bit. And when you compare what Van Sant had in My Own Private Idaho with River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves, somehow putting all of the weight that they were able to carry as, not that they were veterans at that point, but professionals to a degree, putting that on Sasha Lane's shoulders, I think just is too much to bear maybe for me in capturing what you got out of the movie. But definitely one that also sort of seemed to trail off and disappear in terms of interest. So I would encourage people to check it out because it has been divisive. And I know there was a lot of praise for it at first and not too much anymore, but definitely one you're going to have strong feelings about if you see it.
Yeah,
and
check it out. I mean, I need more people on my side about this one.
I was going to say that I'm a fan not only of Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights, a former Golden Brick winner here on the show, but Red Road and Fish Tank as well. So I certainly have no excuse for the fact that I still have not seen American Honey. But we have a disagreement here, Scott. You're going to have to break the tie.
I would say I'm a little more on Genevieve's side than Josh, as though we had some. She's Genevieve's looking at me askance because I think
in my mind you hate this movie.
Yeah,
Scott.
In her mind I hate it, but it's not true.
With me, you're against me.
That's right. It's a little a little more in the middle, but towards the positive end. And what I like about it, and this is another little pet interest of mine, is I really like to see films by foreign filmmakers, filmmakers not from America, about America, and see their perspective on what we are as a country. We were originally thinking of pairing it with Paris, Texas, Wim Wenders' film, which is kind of the ultimate example of that. But I think you get a sense of just a swath of America, that the flyover country, I suppose, that you just don't see otherwise. And it's, I think, a fascinating film. And rough around the edges, sure, but maybe the better for it.
Yeah. Andrea Arnold, an interesting filmmaker for sure, and someone, as Scott said, not American, according to the internet, from Dartford, Kent, England, is where Andrea Arnold was born. My number 8 film, to get at the miracle of this pick, we have to hear, I think, one of its great moments. Ethan Hawke there as one of the all-time great jazz trumpeters, Chet Baker, in Robert Boudreau's Born to Be Blue, following my La La Land pick, another music movie, another LA movie, another industry movie. At this point in the movie, he's recovered from a serious mouth injury. He's sober. He's trying to prove to these industry folks that he's back. He's ready to perform not only after that injury, but after pretty much losing whatever stature he had because of a pretty crippling heroin addiction. And as you heard there, My Funny Valentine, it starts with those very familiar notes on his horn. And then he switches to vocals. And it really shouldn't work. He's there to prove he can play the trumpet the way he used to play. And he mostly sings instead. And he's not a particularly good singer. And I'm speaking of both Hawke and Chet Baker, as the story goes. I haven't heard a whole lot of Chet Baker myself. But he commits to the performance. He connects with the music. He internalizes not just the words, but the soul of the song, and then expresses it in his own idiosyncratic way, which is what I think great artists do. And it's melancholy and haunting and gorgeous and weird and vulnerable. And I say vulnerable, I don't think there's anything feeble about the performance. I'm talking about Baker, the musician, performing My Funny Valentine, though everything I'm saying applies to Hawke's whole performance as Baker. You just get the sense that he's on a precipice and the slightest breeze could send him tumbling down. There's just real stakes to every line and every note he plays. And like Baker in that scene, Boudreau, as the director and the writer, commits to his approach. The tone and style match that Baker, California cool, melancholic sound. And he really wisely focuses on a short time in Baker's life and doesn't commit most of the usual biopic sins. Some have actually labeled the movie an anti-biopic. But it's a deeply romantic movie, too. Carmen Ejogo, who was in Selma, gives one of the best supporting actress turns of the year as the woman who helps heal him physically and emotionally. And Hawke, I think this is the pinnacle in what I was calling clumsily the year of the Hawke. I much prefer Maria Gates. The term she coined, she calls it the Hawkeissance. He was very good to great in five movies just this year alone. Born to Be Blue, Maggie's Plan, In a Valley of Violence, The Phenom, and The Magnificent Seven. And those first four are all definitely worth seeking out. If you haven't seen them already, you can probably skip The Magnificent Seven. In terms of wonderful moments from this movie, you just heard one of them. The ending, too, is a killer. It's probably my favorite ending of any film this year. And of course, that's all I can say about it. But I just have to encourage more people to see Born to Be Blue.
I was getting a little worried. Three picks in. No Ethan Hawke film yet?
I know.
I thought something had changed. But
yeah.
That's,
no, it's right there at number eight. And I mentioned I want to get more people to see it. It's out on DVD, iTunes, on demand, lots of ways to see Born to Be Blue. Am I the only one in the room who has seen this movie and adores it?
I think so. But how do you feel about the Hawkening as a term?
Ooh,
oh,
that's a contender. The Hawkening.
That's my contribution to this pick.
I am all about the Hawkening, but I haven't seen this film, so I'm excited. But I think as an actor, you know, he's completely turned me around. Mm-hmm. I mean, early in his career, you know, that Reality Bites phase, he's just so smug. but as a middle-aged actor, he's just become extraordinary.
He has, and this role speaks to the opposite of that smugness, how lacking in vanity it is and how insecure he is. He's playing a character who at this point still thinks of himself on some level as the great Chet Baker, but he also knows he's not that guy anymore, and so you see that struggle, that fight within him. Josh, you're number seven.
So at number seven, I have a film. We've talked about a few that we felt have not gotten enough attention, including Born to Be Blue. Here's one that is on almost every top 10 list I've seen so far. It's also shared by Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic at Vox.com.
This is Alyssa Wilkinson. I'm the film critic at Vox.com. And I would say my pick for best movie of the year is Barry Jenkins' Moonlight. I'm not sure that I've seen another American film in a really long time that is as sort of carefully and delicately constructed as that one. I think the performances are outstanding all around. I've seen it twice. Probably will see it another time before the end of the year, and I can't even find anything to quibble with. It makes me feel empathy and also have a lot of memories of my own just watching it. So I think that we're lucky to have had it, and I hope that lots of people see it as a result of the praise and the awards that have been heaped on it. So good work, and thank you to Barry Jenkins for taking the time to make it. Merry Christmas.
Alyssa mentioned empathy there, and what's so wonderful about Moonlight for me is one particular way it achieves this quality, and that's in its cinematography. In our review, I mentioned how director Barry Jenkins and his cinematographer James Laxton, they make this one of the rare films that knows how to honor the various textures and tones of African-American skin. Mm. So whether we're watching the main character as little, Chiron, or Black, and three different actors play him during three different stages of his life, he's bathed in the same generous light. They manage a consistency there. Now, sometimes that's literal moonlight and taking it right from the title. But even during the daytime scenes, especially that indelible one in the water where he is having swimming lessons, we feel this same attentive, loving tone.
Give me a head. Okay. Let your head rest in my hand. Relax. I got you. I promise. I'm not gonna let you go. Hey, man, I got you. There you go. 10 seconds. That right there? You're in the middle of the world, man.
Now, so many elements do come into play into making Moonlight this really unique experience. There's the performances, of course, the unexpected use of music, which I really appreciated. But for me, it all comes down to the way the film casts not just the main character, all of its characters in this beautiful light of grace.
Yeah, I mean, Moonlight happens to be my number seven, too. So we'll just keep talking about it.
Let's do it.
Yeah, I share your love for the cinematography of this film. And it's just emphasis on accomplishing things visually as much as possible. Dialogue is perfectly fine. It's a good script, but the images are what really stands out in the film. The performances are remarkable. I appreciate the Wong Kar-wai movie that breaks out in the final third. And I particularly like how it's about a young man discovering and coming to terms with his identity, even after other people have recognized it before him and have hardened their positions on it. And it's just, it's such kind of a sad thing for him to recognize what people already see and then to realize that those feelings have no place in the environment that he's in. It's crushing, but then also, you know, it does have kind of a sliver of hope and romanticism there as well. It's a really unique film.
That scene you mentioned with the water, it's easily my scene of the year. I don't think I breathed that entire entire shot. So much of this film is filmed with such immediacy, and I think that is what's responsible for the empathy that Alyssa mentioned in her call. It's just kind of impossible not to feel what this character is feeling when you are so close to what he's experiencing just visually.
I think there may be more about Moonlight coming over the course of these two episodes. So Genevieve, let's get to your number 7 film of the year.
Well, Josh already did most of the hard work in explaining why I loved Loving, which is my number 7 of the year. The only thing that I will add, we already talked about how great the performances are and how it foregrounds their marriage, but I think that those both speak to what I'm realizing about Jeff Nichols is that he's such an emotion-focused director. Like, it's always less about what is happening in the story than in how the people on screen are reacting to what's happening. And that, I think, is what makes Loving work as a kind of an emotional journey rather than a procedural that it could have been.
Yeah.
I want to ask you all a question about the one sticking point people seem to have about this movie, or at least the polarizing element of it. What do you think of Nick Kroll's performance in this film?
You know, Richard, it's of course up to you not to attend, but you should know the Supreme Court only hears one out of every 400 cases. It's historic.
Thank you, Mr. Kroll.
Well, is there anything you'd like me to say to them? And by them, I mean the Supreme Court justices of the United States?
You know, it's a minor element, mm-hmm. and I don't think it's derailing, even though I recognized him and thought, oh, he's getting a shot at a dramatic role, which happens quite frequently. I don't understand it as a major point of contention.
Yeah, I would say I don't mind it.
I'm inventing a controversy that perhaps doesn't exist. Though I will say, of course, Jeff Nichols has to use Michael Shannon in mm-hmm. this movie. And when he does, I think that is my favorite.
Yeah.
It's a great scene. He plays a photographer from Life magazine who shows up.
Yeah, just him taking those pictures of the two of them watching TV together.
Yeah.
Wow.
Way more ebullience than we ever get from Michael Shannon right? on screen and joy. And I love seeing that part of him. And I'm just going to say we're 3 for 3. On thinking that Nick Kroll is perfectly acceptable. So, okay. Sorry, Scott.
Your Kroll vendetta will find no traction here.
I'm trying to start a dust up. I think Michael Phillips would hear it were here. He would mix
maybe
it up
so.
With me over there.
Maybe yeah. so. All right, my number 7 is the movie Krisha. And among the miracles of this movie, we look at the genre that the director, Trey Edward Schultz, making his feature debut here, is working within, as familiar perhaps as the based on real events genre, the dysfunctional family gathering movie around the holidays. But he immerses us in a way that I think feels fresh and thrilling, even if it's also overwhelming and at times terrifying. And I think you can spot in the movie, but it's certainly not beholden to these influences in any way. You can see Malick, you can see Altman, you can see Cassavetes, and you can see horror as well. And I got to give credit to Allison Wilmore from Film Spotting SVU and BuzzFeed. She wrote a great piece over at BuzzFeed called 5 Ways This Thanksgiving Drama Looks and Feels Like a Horror Movie, and she really dissects it nicely. I'll link to that in our show notes at filmspotting.net. But for me, it's the face that opens the movie and drives the movie that's the most stunning. Krisha Fairchild's performance as Krisha. The only way I can try to articulate it is to compare a performance to another one that we on the show, like most cinephiles, revere. Maria Falconetti in The Passion of Joan of Arc, and she may suffer even more than Joan does on screen somehow. The family members she's been estranged from for 10 years serving as her judges and jailers. There's just a rawness and a volatility to Krisha that recalls certainly an unhinged Jenna Rollins in A Woman Under the Influence, but also the best performances we've seen by non-professional actors. And some of the cast here is non-professional. She is not. She's got credits going back to 1992 on IMDb. And I'm not trying to pay her a backhanded compliment in any way. I don't think it's an amateurish performance. It's just that if you told me while watching the movie that she had fought all of the same addiction problems as her character, all those same demons, and was in recovery, or that she really was related to all of these people, and somehow Schultz was, let's say, decorating what was otherwise an actual family gathering, I would have bought anything you were trying to sell me. I think the performance is just that good. And the moment I want to single out is when she does open a bottle of wine. She finally does break down in the bathroom, and a record starts downstairs. Sardonically, we hear some applause as she pops that cork before Nina Simone's Just in Time. And the camera tracks her slow-mo. Actually, she's not in the shot. It's her point of view, tracking down the hallway into darkness, then down into the kitchen. And we get Krisha's point of view as she's surveying her son and all of the people engaged in conversation and all laughing and seemingly having a very heartwarming time. The lighting is really dramatic. There's a nice, unnerving use of candid angles, and it's all still in slow-mo. And then Schultz breaks into real time as we get what I can only call the great turkey spill of 2016. And I've already invoked Malick and Altman and Cassavetes, so why not throw another master into the mix? Rewatching this scene last night, I thought of Scorsese. I thought of the use of camera and editing and music, the way we see De Niro's entrance in Mean Streets. And as long as we're talking about miracles, this movie looks so good and applies all those techniques. And Schultz filmed it in his mother's house in Houston in 9 days and shot it for less than under $100,000. So, young filmmakers out there, you have that to reckon with as well once you finally see Krisha.
I mean, to me, it was the debut film of the year. I mean, certainly on a directorial level, what stunned me about it, I mean, for one, it's kind of this a very Cassavetes Thanksgiving happening, but I was impressed by just how aggressive it is stylistically, particularly with sound, how it captures her sense of dislocation and
disorientation,
stress.
Disorientation, yeah. Huge part of the movie.
Through sound and how you feel it. And it's a tough film in that sense. I mean, I think it could be a more accessible film if it didn't have that kind of aggression. But, you know, and I don't think people would be calling it a horror film, but I think it plays as such. And it feels very real to her experience. And you really are with her all the way, while at the same time understanding why everyone is so frustrated with her and why her appearance is causing so much stress for everyone around her. So.
Yeah, and Michael Phillips, not here, though certainly here in spirit. We've uttered his name several times. He had this movie as his number 6 movie of the year and had a great line. Each shift in perspective, even aspect ratio, the screen scrunches up subtly at key moments in Krisha's crisis seems to come from or speak to Krisha's psyche. And I think that speaks to the point you were just making as well, Scott. There's also a really good anatomy of a scene, not this scene, but a breakdown of a scene from the film with Mikado Murphy, longtime friend of the show, and Trey Edward Schultz over at the New York Times. I will link to that in our show notes. And you can see this movie. It's on iTunes, not on DVD, but iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play. As it turns out, we have a voicemail contribution from one Trey Edward Schultz. And no, he did not pick his own movie as the best film of the year, but he did choose a movie that I don't think is otherwise going to come up in our top 10 lists, so I'm glad it's going to get some love from Trey.
Hello, Film Spotting. This is Trey Schultz, the director of Krisha. I don't know what my favorite movie of the year is because I'm terrible with lists, and I'm in post-production on my new movie, and I feel like I've barely seen anything. But I love everything. Everyone seems to be loving, like La La Land and Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea. One movie I wanted to throw some love on that I feel like enough people aren't talking about is Arrival. You know, I think it's rare to have a big budget sci-fi movie these days that isn't built around action spectacle, and it's about ideas and emotion. And I think the craft behind this film is incredible. Bradford Young's cinematography, Johan Johansson's score, and the director, you know, and the subjectivity he brings to it. Amy Adams is incredible. So I feel like everyone I talk to is kind of lukewarm on this movie, and I thought it was beautiful. I loved it. I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's one of my favorites. Longtime listener, first time caller, keep doing what you do, guys. Huge fan. Bye.
Thank you very much for that, Trey. One of those people who is mixed on the film, Josh Larson. We will shut off his mic for a second.
Whoa. You're trying to throw me under the 10 Cloverfield Lane bus here. This and Krisha, I gave three out of four stars.
He didn't make Arrival.
That it didn't make my top 10 list.
That's what I'm saying.
Don't put me in that category.
Okay, fine. I guess if you have to ruin everything with facts. I know that you two, Scott and Genevieve, are big fans of Arrival as well.
Yeah, I mean, Scott, I think a little more than me, but we had a amicable throwdown on the Next Picture Show.
Was it a throwdown?
Not really. It was more a slight airing of differences, But you know, I agree with everything said about the film, and kind of the only real sticking point for me is, I think, a very individual and personal one, which is like how I emotionally reacted to the story. Mm-hmm. And that is obviously going to vary from person to person and the baggage you bring into the movie. But on a technical level, a performance level, there's nothing to argue with there. And I particularly love the shout out of Bradford Young's cinematography, because I think he's extraordinary.
Yeah, I had it on my list. It would probably be 11, I suppose, on my list. I had it on there, and if you look at my handwritten list, it's up probably around 8, and then I scratched it off, and I don't know why I did that. I saw it twice. I saw it first at Toronto, and it absolutely destroyed me emotionally at Toronto, because the beginning of the film has that Max Richter music, and you just kind of file it away in your brain, in the deep recesses of your brain, and then most of the film is very intellectually engaging, kind of a puzzle piece. It's absolutely fascinating to see this kind of global effort to communicate with an alien being, and all the dynamics of that are fascinating, the science of that is fascinating, and then suddenly the film, the Richter piece comes back, and the film suddenly took me to an emotional place that I did not expect, and it just destroyed me. left me kind of just having to collect myself in the middle of the big theater at Toronto while everybody else was collecting their things. It was just, it was really a great experience.
This is a movie that definitely benefits, I think, from the ability to talk about it in terms of spoilers, which obviously we won't do here, but we did on Film Spotting, if you missed that, episode 613, which is at filmspotting.net, and in iTunes, we talked about The Edge of 17 and other topics, but at the end, we spent a good 15 minutes diving into the end of that film. And just, I think earlier today, I don't know how it came up, but I just overheard people randomly out in public talking about this film, and someone said something along the lines of, I just didn't understand that phone call. Mm-hmm. And I wanted so badly to interject myself into that conversation and try to lay it all out there for him, but I did not do that. That emotional versus intellectual reaction to the film was a big part of our conversation. Before we get to our final pick of this show, part one of our top 10 films of the year, we did want to share some poll results. A couple of weeks back, we asked listeners to name their favorite film of 2016, but we did use some very specific language. We wanted to know what your favorite movie of the year was that we reviewed and at least one of us loved. Josh, the options were...
All right, Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some, Green Room, that's from Jeremy Sunier, the Coen brothers' Hail Caesar, The Lobster, from director Yorgos Lanthimos, the much-lauded and already-discussed Moonlight, from director Barry Jenkins, John Carney's Sing Street, Clint Eastwood's Sully, and The Witch, the New England folktale, from first-time feature director Robert Eggers.
Here is how it came out. No love for my beloved Sully, 2%. Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some, 9%. The Coen brothers' Hail Caesar, 10%. My also-beloved Sing Street, a little bit better than Sully, 12%. Green Room, 13%. The Witch, 16%. Moonlight, 17%. And the winner, though not very many big gaps there, The Lobster, Yorgos Lanthimos, did edge out the other contenders with 20% of the vote. And the timing of this poll can explain some notable absences of films like La La Land and Manchester by the Sea, Jackie, Silence, Arrival. We just really hadn't seen them at the time this poll came out. And a few of them we just didn't really love all that much. And we're guessing most people who voted find themselves in that same boat where you probably have yet to catch up with all of these films. We got this great response from Alex Lovendahl. And Josh, you have to take this one away. I mean, this has Massacre Theater written all over it. Are you ready?
No. Alex, you don't demand that you sing something when he knows very well we have a voicemail number.
Dance, monkey, dance.
No way.
Yes, and I mean, I really want you to
I
dance.
I did recently watch this, so I can't do the whole thing. Let me see here if there's a part I can do. All right.
I may want to pick the witch, as Black Phillip makes me itch, but I ain't gonna pick a dame.
No dames. We might see some octopuses.
No dames.
Or a half a dozen clams.
No dames.
We might even see a mermaid.
But mermaids got no dames.
No.
He's got more great lyrics here we can share,
there's
but I'm
like
not singing anymore.
There's three more sentences left, Josh. How dare you?
It's very funny, Alex.
Deprive our audience, but obviously Hail Caesar, the choice that Alex is going with as he references that very memorable scene from that film about Hollywood from the Coen brothers featuring Channing Tatum. Daniel from Nashville, he didn't make us sing. When I saw the choices, I thought I was going to have to choose between The Lobster and Hail Caesar. And then I remembered how I felt when I walked out of the theater at 2 a.m. after seeing Everybody Wants Some. If you had asked what the best movie of the year was, I might have a different answer, but that emotional high from Linklater's film might still be clouding my judgment in this poll.
Jonathan Kissel in Atlanta said, I've seen all but two of these, and while Moonlight and Everybody Wants Some were great, it's The Lobster and a Runaway. The sense of discovery that comes from watching a Lanthimos film is unparalleled. The best cast of the year, the best narration in years, and an ending for the ages. It's not only my favorite movie of the year, it's my favorite movie since Freddie Quell sat down with Lancaster Dodd in The Master.
Well, speaking of Paul Thomas Anderson, Jason Eakin writes, if Paul Thomas Anderson made a horror movie, The Witch is what it would look like. For all the love given to horror movies in the past few years, and deservedly so, I think this is the crowning achievement of them all. It's dark and upsetting and painful and eerie and about family and faith and tragedy and doubt. It's a tough watch, but it's so rewarding.
A couple of more notes here. This one from Tyler Hanan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Part of me wanted to cast my vote for The Witch, giving love to a great horror movie that shook me to my core. Then there's Green Room, a smart, gripping thriller from a director I'll always open my wallet for after Film Spotting turned me on to Blue Ruin. It was never really a contest, though. With apologies to the incredible Yorgos Lanthimos, my vote has to go to Moonlight. It's a film so beautiful and tender that it challenged my belief that no movie or piece of art is truly perfect.
And a perfect bow following that sentiment, Natalia in Toronto adds, in 2017, I just want one thing, to live in a world where Barry Jenkins is making another movie. It was just a couple weeks ago, but funny now to think that we were considering Moonlight as a possible Golden Brick nominee, our award that goes to the overlooked or underseen movie of the year. It has been sweeping many of the year-end awards and will surely be a favorite come Oscar season. So I think we chose wisely there, Josh.
Yeah, allowed
to
us
leave it off.
To get another film in the Golden Brick running, and listeners can help us choose the winner of the Golden Brick. That's by voting in the current Film Spotting poll. So you get to choose among the five finalists for this year's award, and those are Kirsten Johnson's Camera Person, my number 8 film of the year, Anna Rose Holmer's The Fitz, Trey Edward Schultz's Kreisha, Adam, your number 8, and Keith Maitland's Tower, another documentary there. We'll round it out with a fifth film that is also documentary, James Solomon's The Witness. Again, you can vote on which film of those you want to see win the Golden Brick at filmspotting.net. Do leave us some feedback on that. Also, let us know where you're listening from. And we're going to announce the winner of the 2016 Golden Brick Award at our January 13th live show.
Yeah, and I do want to reiterate that the listener vote counts just as much as my vote or your vote, Josh, and even Scott Tobias, his vote, and Genevieve Kosky. They are all members of our Blue Ribbon panel selecting the winner of our Golden Brick Award. We get back into the countdown now with our number 6 films of the year, and we start with another voicemail.
Hey, Film Spotting. This is Max O'Connell, formerly of Critic Wire, now of the Rapid City Journal, calling in with my favorite film of 2016, and that is Ryusuke Hamaguchi's Happy Hour. It's a rare, intimate epic. It's 5 hours long, where intimacy is the epic, and the film that surprised me the most with this year, the one with the greatest empathetic reach. If you haven't seen it, keep an eye out for it. Thanks. Keep up the great work.
Always nice to hear from Max O'Connell picking a movie like your Aquarius pick, Scott, that frankly I was completely unfamiliar with coming into this taping. But as I look at the results of the IndieWire critic survey, which I think most of us here in the room were part of, if not all of us, that film Happy Hour came in at number 35 among the top 50 films of the year. Are we all so unfortunate as to have not had the 5-hour experience that is Happy Hour?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Sounds right up your alley, Scott.
I love 5-hour movies. It's one of those things, though, if a film is that long and you're with it, then course it's going to be your favorite film of the year. You just spent Good 5 hours watching it.
You put in the investment.
You got to validate that experience. We can't validate your experience, Max, but thank you so much for the voicemail. Josh, you're number six.
Here it is, Scott. The Neon Demon here, right, at number six. I don't know if Nicholas Winding Refn's gonzo fashion industry extravaganza made Alison Wilmore's top 10. I think we're going to hear her number one pick at some point here. But I do know that she shares my appreciation of it as a strobe lit fairy tale rather than any sort of contemporary satire speaking to the way things are right now. This follows a 16-year-old model played by Elle Fanning who quickly rises to prominence at her own risk in the LA fashion world. And it's another 2016 movie for me where the cinematography is as important to the film as anything else. Natasha Breyer is the cinematographer. There's this moment in The Neon Demon that I think of as the Narcissus sequence in which Fanning's Jessie is on stage at a fashion show and she enters this triangle of neon and mirrors where she kisses her own reflection. I think the movie is ultimately suggesting that narcissism eats the beautiful for breakfast. And it filters this through the fairy tale motifs that it employs. So you've got dangerous animals, you've got witches, you've got all out cannibalism. I mean, this, like a lot of Refn, this is not one for the faint of heart. What's especially clever for me about The Neon Demon is that Fanning's Jessie comes to be, you know, she seems to be set up as the victim at first, but she's really the trickiest figure in these woods. She's almost part Little Red Riding Hood and part wolf. And to watch that play back and forth is pretty captivating.
I thought you did great. Don't do that. Pretend that you don't know. People see you. They notice. Do you know how lucky you are? I'm a ghost. What's it feel like? What do you mean? To walk into a room. And it's like in the middle of winter, you're the sun. It's everything.
I'd almost lost faith in Winning Refn after Only God Forgives and started to see a little bit more of what his detractors had maybe always pointed out. But I have to say I'm back on board after this one.
Yeah, that dynamic with her character is my favorite aspect of The Neon Demon as well, and was one of the key talking points in my interview earlier this year with Nicholas Winding Refn and Elle Fanning. Had them both here in the studio, episode 591 of Film Spotting, if you're curious. One of the more fun conversations I think I had all year anyway. It was good for me. I don't know how good it was for them. Scott, you are a fan of The Neon Demon. You must be pleased with Josh's selection.
I'm pleased because I really was determined to put it on my list and it didn't end up there. But, I mean, all the things you mentioned are important. I think the look of the film, just the last three films especially, he's developed a really strong, distinct style. You know, obviously, the use of color is really startling. And I think the film is also about the male gaze and this, in the way this system, this Hollywood system, is enforced upon women. I mean, there's an air of threat that's carried out throughout the film that's important and disturbing. But then it's also the system that in which these women are encouraged or goaded into turning on each other. And so it's kind of reinforced as well. So I think it's a fascinating film. I think it's got a lot of depth to it. And it was one, I think, that for whatever reason, critics felt very comfortable about dismissing it out of hand. And I think that's unfair. I think there's a lot to discuss in this movie. So
we're ready for your number six then.
Okay. My number six is a film called Right Now, Wrong Then. This is the new film from Korean director Hong Sang-soo, though I shouldn't say new because he's got a film every year or so. And he's kind of become, for me, what Woody Allen used to be until about 25 years ago, somebody who turned out a new movie every year and it was a treat. You know, usually his films are about a filmmaker, you know, his relationships with women. There's lots of drinking soju to excess. And, you know, his films are reliably delightful. Right Now, Wrong Then, I think, is significantly more ambitious than his recent work has been. It runs through one day in a director's courtship of a painter to whom he is attracted. And then it runs through that same day again in the second half of the film with just a slight change in circumstances. And we can see how small choices and twists of fate dramatically alter the relationship between two people, especially, you know, when they first meet. So right now, wrong then.
We've only dipped our toes into the Hong Sang-soo waters. It's a movie that has been on my radar and I wish I had been able to see, but Woman on the Beach, I think, is the only film of his maybe that we've seen. It was part of our Korean O'Tours marathon
maybe
a little while back,
ago,
and
so.
Most people agreed it probably wasn't the best of his films.
That's Upair. That's his Upair film, right? Woman on the Beach is
recall
not his?
Okay, her I'm being the star of that one.
No, but maybe it was another title. This is a filmmaker who clearly deserves his own marathon, and maybe it wasn't smart to kind of squeeze him into another marathon because I know he's so beloved, and with that sort of output as well, there's plenty to
it's
dig
intimidating.
Into.
And I actually caught him nice and early, and I really appreciated his earlier work, which is a little bit more ambitious and a little bit on a larger scale, which is why I appreciated this film a lot. So if you really want to start somewhere with him, I would start with something like Turning Gate. Would be, I think, the place to go with him. But, you know, he's got a very small but extraordinarily devoted group of fans, of which I am one.
Genevieve, your number six.
My number six is The Fitz. Anna Rose Holmer's debut is the definition of beguiling. It's hard to say exactly what happens in this movie, or more precisely, why it's happening. But it's so transportive and immersive in this very specific way that just I was really taken with. The story follows a young girl named Toni who sort of inhabits this community center where she's learning boxing alongside her brother. And she's sort of drawn into this dance troupe made up of older girls. And things start happening. And it's not clear why they're happening, but it's hard to look away from.
We were all just in the Latin, and Madison went crazy.
What do you mean, crazy?
She started shaking all over the place.
Was the whole team there?
Pretty much.
You guys talking about Madison? It was crazy. She was like, and her eyes was like, and then her tongue.
Royalty Hightower is the young actress who plays Toni, and she is such a delight to watch. She's more of a physical presence than anything in this movie. Just the way she portrays Toni's evolution as a dancer and kind of finds this interesting middle ground between the physicality of boxing and dancing, it's really extraordinary for someone so young and presumably inexperienced. But yeah, The Fitz, it's a movie I think you feel more than anything.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The physicality is such a key part to that. And I think you're right to tie it to performance here. The first time I saw this, I was impressed with Hightower, but maybe was not yet ready for a performance that didn't do what we normally, a little bit to what I said about La La Land. You know, we expect certain things to be attached to characters.
Yeah.
And when we're not given those in the exact way we usually do, maybe we don't know how to take them. But what she does and what Anna Rose Holmer focuses on with her camera about this young girl in terms of how she's using her body, being asked to use her body, tells us everything we need to know about her.
Before we get to my number six, I did want to feature one more voice, and I feel like it's a nice pairing, perhaps, Genevieve, with The Fitz, as that's a movie certainly about the female experience, directed by an up-and-coming, emerging female director, and we have a choice here for Best Film of the Year that is also very much about the female experience, directed by one of our great, more established women directors.
Hi, I'm Tina Hastania. I'm a freelance film critic from Canada. One of my favorite films of 2016 is Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women. This is a true masterclass on the experience of microaggression from three very different women who all inhabit the same town. And they have very unique experiences, yet the overarching theme is just this idea that no matter what women do, no matter how hard they try to communicate, they constantly come up against people who either don't respect them or don't hear them, usually both. And in most cases, those people are men, but, you know, not always. And I just love the way that Reichardt is able to create these incredibly believable scenes between characters. The dialogue, it's just, you know, they don't have to say too much, but you can just feel the things that are left unsaid.
Tina was so great when she came on, I think, episode 593 to talk about Abbas Kiarostami, paying tribute to his work as he passed away this year. She's really an expert when it comes to his film. So we thank her for that and thank her for that voicemail. Certain Women, not a film that made my top 10, but I am a huge fan of that movie. And at the risk of sounding like an over-promotional broken record, I will point out that Kelly Reichardt also was a guest on Film Spotting this year. Talked to her a few months ago, and I'll link to that interview in our show notes if you are curious.
Certain Women, one of those movies I knew I was underrating as I was watching
yeah.
it, as I was reviewing it, and as I'm thinking about it now.
Yeah.
And probably one of those, if I had had a chance to revisit, might have squeezed its way up onto my list.
Yeah, it would have been. It's top 15, I guess, mm-hmm. for me. I mean, that last segment is the one that really
knocked
you out with Lily Gladstone and Kristen Stewart. Though I wonder if it really fits into the theme that Tina sets up in that email, but I guess we shouldn't really get in.
Can't argue with her when she's not here.
Exactly right. But I don't want to argue about this anyway, because I think it is a very good film. And Kelly Reichardt is somebody who has often worked from short stories and has a style that, you know, where everyone else is making novels, she's making short stories on screen. And she just does a lot of little things and lets it go. And Certain Women is a great example of that.
So my number six film of 2016 does have two women featured very prominently at the center of the story, certainly about their experience, but couldn't be more different from Certain Women in terms of its style and approach. It is Park Chan-wook's The Handmaiden. I have to go to my favorite joke in the movie here. You have two characters who are engaged in a prolonged, quite explicit act of lovemaking that one of the two entered into believing the other was a novice. And despite having been going at it strong for like 15 minutes already, the novice does something that provokes the more experienced partner to say with astonishment, "You must be a natural." And it was a genuine laugh out loud moment in a movie with many laugh out loud moments. I think that might be the biggest miracle of The Handmaiden, that the writer and director of Old Boy, best known probably for that film and that macabre revenge trilogy, could make a movie this funny. But I think that joke also underscores what the whole movie is about. One of my favorite themes, storytelling. That character naively clings to the narrative she's created for that other character, despite all the evidence to the contrary. And she can't alter that narrative regardless of that evidence, because it would shatter the narrative she's also created for herself. So there are lots of layers at play here, a lot of misdirection. It pretty quickly turns into a con movie where we as viewers have to figure out who the real Mark is and how much we might be the Marks, what trick Park is pulling on us as well. And that's another thing I love about the movie, is that he's taking advantage of our ability to be manipulated by a story, to make assumptions about characters and their motivations, but he's doing it in a really playful way. There's no condescension to it at all, no separation between storyteller and audience. He's really rather putting us on equal unsure ground with the characters themselves, and it's very effective. In terms of moments that stand out from this film, there are many. On Letterboxd, Claire Ginocchio mentioned the library scene, and you would know it if you've seen it. She said, "One of my favorite cinematic scenes ever, tear it down." And it's definitely a great scene of feminine defiance. But I would also point to Min-hee Kim's reading for the aristocratic book lovers, including what I can only call the hoisting. And then the eroticism of the bathtub tooth rubbing scene that might just change the way you view your next trip to the dentist. It's an incredibly romantic film, in addition to being an incredibly funny film. And I don't think there's another more beautiful film to look at frame by frame this year. And I will put La La Land up against Park Chan-wook's The Handmaiden.
Yeah, that when you talk about manipulation, that's just one of the ways this does remind me of Hitchcock, the audience manipulation going on here. And this is one I recently was able to see and wanted to, because, again, it had been getting a lot of love from the Chicago Film Critics group. And the only way I could describe it to people afterwards was that it's origami Hitchcock, because not only the Japanese influence, of course, but this idea of structure, that it unfolds in turn. And we wouldn't want to give away any of the unfolding, but it sort of becomes something different when it unpacks itself and not only manipulates you, but it turns it into an entirely different film with the same players.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much to love about this movie, and I will probably get into some of those things a little later, spoiler alert. But one thing I do want to talk about right now is that I think it's really extraordinary as an adaptation, because I went into this movie having read Sarah Waters' The Fingersmith, which is what it is adapted from. And so I knew all those twists going in, and every single one of them was still incredibly effective. And I think that's a lot due to Park Chan-wook's direction. But this movie is very faithful to the source material while also turning it into something else entirely by shifting the setting from Victorian England to Japan-occupied Korea. And just that twist is enough to just lend this great specificity and little extra level of unexpectedness to the story that I already knew very well.
Well, that's part one. Guys, any closing thoughts, or are we ready to actually maybe prepare for part two next week on the show?
I think we just got to keep plowing through. Of course, there will be a week break for listeners.
Yep.
But we're going to stick around and talk about our top five picks.
You mean we're not just going to sit here in the studio for a week and wait for this to play out?
We could, but let's just get it done.
We're
going
to be chained. It's like it'll be like Black Snake Moan.
There you go.
Be chained to the radiator.
That is part one of our top 10 films of the year countdown. We will be back with part two next week, as we said, and we would love to hear from you. We have already featured a few listener voicemails, listener picks for the best film of the year. We will get to more in part two, and we would love to, of course, hear any comments you have about the show. Feedback at filmspotting.net is our email. We are also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Filmspotting, and Josh is Larson on Film. At our website, filmspotting.net is where you can find almost 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archive. And if you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your podcast app. And I suppose I have to follow that with the question, Scott and Genevieve, what's next for The Next Picture Show?
Well, coming up, we have what is apparently going to be a somewhat divisive discussion on La La Land, and our movie, our classic movie pairing with that will be Jacques Demy's The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Perfect. Yep. Indeed. Thank you guys so much for coming on. We will, of course, hear from you in part two. Where can listeners find your stuff? What would you like to plug?
Listeners can find, I guess, my film reviews at places like NPR, Village Voice, UpRocks, Variety, places like that. And then I've done a lot of television and other feature work at New York Times, Washington Post, other such outlets.
Writing about TV.
Writing about
lots of TV.
Writing about TV, doing features on film. I'm a utility man right now.
Fair enough, Genevieve.
I am mostly behind the scenes at the Vox.com culture section, but I will occasionally pop my head out and write something about movies or television or whatever strikes my fancy. And I am on Twitter at Genevieve Koski.
All right, guys. Thanks again. Out wide this weekend, Assassin's Creed, Michael Fassbender and Marion Cotillard reteam with their Macbeth director, Justin Kurzel, that opened on the 21st. Passengers, the latest starring Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt. They are lost in space, directed by The Imitation Game's Morten Tildum. Sing, and we have to mention the opening line from David Ehrlich's Letterboxd review. Before we talk about Sing, let's talk about Satan. I'm way more interested in that film all of a sudden, and I was already pretty interested. That's out on Friday the 23rd. And why him? James Franco, Bryan Cranston, directed by John Hamburg, the director of I Love You, Man, which is a movie I thought was pretty hilarious. And I've seen this trailer now three or four times, and I have to admit, I laugh a fair amount through the trailer.
It wore you down, huh?
It wore me down. Franco's a comedic genius. We know that. Out in limited release on Christmas Day, Fences, Hidden Figures, and Lion.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. If you liked what you just heard, we ask that you do give us a review or a rating on iTunes. It really does help us reach new listeners. That's always a good thing. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.